Thank you very much for tuning in to Scenes of Violence on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Steve Hamilton, and we are going to be talking with Dave McGlenn. If you're not familiar with Dave McGlenn, Google, you'll find him. Dave's a real close friend and co-worker with us in the Army fire protection world. Dave's been working at West Point. He's been working mostly in the Northeast for the most part, but we worked in collaboration with each other in building training plans for Army Fire Protection or Army Fire and Emergency Services. And it's the main reason I wanted to bring him on the show tonight, because we're starting off on 2022, and it begs the question, violent scene response. And when I say that, we're talking everything from everyday scenes of violence, domestic assaults, shootings, stabbings, things like that, all the way up through full-blown active shooter, complex coordinated attack. How do we go about building that into our annual training plan and addressing that integration with the normal training that we had planned for the year? How do we go about doing that? So I'm going to bring Dave on a little bit. Let him kind of tell you a little bit more about himself. Much, much better at that than I am. So Dave, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm sorry. Chief McGlenn. I apologize.
Yeah. Just sitting here laughing, man.
The comfortability that we have, since you have a show and I have a show, is probably makes us a bit unorthodox.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. Yeah. No, it'll be fun. No, I appreciate it, man. Thank you. I like I told you, you know, when you asked me to come on, I appreciate you having me on. I'm certainly no subject matter expert in this. You're always the guy that I go to. But as we talk tonight, it is something that's extremely important. I wouldn't say that it technically falls under the category of being like taboo or stigmatic, but I don't think that it is, as much as just it's not sexy enough. And it shouldn't be sexy because of what it is, but in the fire service, we're talking about building training plans and training programs for this type of stuff, right? So it's so easy to get guys engaged and jacked up to do cool and fun training, right? But when it's stuff that they don't find attractive, and then it's not as much fun, and it becomes a chore, it becomes a task, and that's kind of the question is how do we make such a horrible, horrible thing? How do we make it fun in the realm of training so that the guys are kind of more engaged?
Well, I think you said, you know, it's taboo, which is, it's not a bad word. I think it's hazmat in 1985.
That's perfect.
And we're telling everybody, we need to do this hazmat training. We need to do this. And it's that. Is the possibility for you to go to something complex and complicated in a hazardous material world within your jurisdiction? Absolutely. I mean, without question. Are you prepared for it the way we were trying to get people prepared in the mid-80s, you know, even into the into the early 90s and beyond, were we really jumping at the opportunity to dive into hazmat and to cover that and help people understand how significant and serious it was? You had two dichotomies, which similar to what you have now. People are like, yeah, sign me up. I'll do what you want. Take me to training. Teach me. I'm all about it. And you got other people, that ain't my job. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, that last part there is definitely what, at least I'll just tell you from my own experience in dealing with it, you know, and I'm not knocking anybody. You know, I've been very blessed and fortunate to have been in the places and positions and worked with the people that I have. But I can tell you, just from being responsible for either facilitating or some form of designation of a program for responding to, you know, ASHER and active shooter RTF responses, I can tell you that is the mentality with some folks. There are people, I'll never forget, I had a guy say, when we were talking about standing this up over at West Point, and I had a guy, he said, you got another thing coming if you think that I'm going to go in there while these people are shooting and blah, 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 you know. And that's, you know, that's not part of my job and this and that. And I remember laughing to myself, like, but you'll run into a burning building and that's okay, but this part is unsafe. Like, and I got it. I'm not trying to downplay it. Like, it's unsafe, you know, and the easy early initial perception is, well, that's the cops' jobs, you know, like we don't go in there when people are shooting. And that's just it, is the education piece of it is, you know, RTF, and Steve, I'm not going to steal your thunder because you should talk more about that, but, you know, RTF Rescue Task Force, standing up a Rescue Task Force team, you're not going in there when people are shooting bullets at you, you know, almost never. You know, that team gets activated and enters the building when the building is considered a warm zone now, you know, which
that's the,
in
the general
terms,
idea.
That's the general idea. I mean, you know, shit happens. And if something could pop off, there could be a secondary shooter or something, you know, and same as in the fire service, you know, we train to a certain way that we're going to fight the fire and attack it and look at different signs that will tell us or point us in a certain direction so that we maintain some kind of safety. But at the end of the day, it's situational deviation. Things change. Everything we do comes with a large inherent risk. And this is just another one of those. You know, so though I'd like to be empathetic, or at least try to be sympathetic and say to the folks that they might think, you know, that, well, where does it stop? You know, I mean, you just, you know, we're the Swiss Army knife. It's, you know, we got to do everything. Yeah, you know, I can be sympathetic to a point and say, you know, it is the truth. You know, the reason why we get tasked with everything is because firemen never say no. You know, we never, ever say no. We're almost our own worst enemy sometimes, you know, like, in the realm and what we're dealing with in the Army, you know, Steve, and even the rest of the country, you know, with the way things are going with the country, with the finances and all that, they're browning out stations, they're closing firehouses, they're, you know, putting a reduction in force through attrition as people leave or retire or whatever, you know, they're just not backfilling their positions. And yet we still do the job. So we are our own worst enemy. So, you know, I do get that, why would we add another task? However, we have been responding to these incidents since the beginning of time. We learned that we should have been doing more, unfortunately, because people were bleeding out because, you know, like, I don't mean to use Columbine. It's just, it's the one that's the most, it's, you know, it's the brightest light of all of these things. So let's just talk about that for 1 second.
And
you know,
the
1999,
one that started all of this, so.
Sure, and wasn't that long ago. You know, 1999 is when that happened. And if you look at the photos and the videos, the firefighters are there, you know, but they're not in the building. But there's a ton of ambulances, there's a ton of fire trucks, there's a ton of EMS and fire personnel, you know, and a lot of kids bled out. And that's none of their fault. I'm not trying to say that. I'm saying we weren't trained. We didn't know that we should be doing this. So now that we recognize that and we're we're realizing that we need to start training on this because, you know, it's unfortunately we live in a world where it's inevitable. So we need to become better prepared so we can be better proficient at it. But like I said earlier, is just that's the task in itself is how do you make that fun? Because it's a very taxing new task, and it comes with a lot of opposition. Like folks, like I dealt with at West Point, saying, "Well, that's not my job. That's the cop's job. I'm not going to run in while bullets are flying at me." You know, and as comical as it was, because it's like, "Well, you'll go and rappel off of the Storm King Mountain, you know, or go into a fully involved fire in the city of Newburgh, but you won't go into this." But then it's like, but you know, they also had a point. You know, that is the early initial perception is why am I doing a cop's job? Because that's what it looks like. So that's where, you know, the show, like what you're doing, you know, with the show and what you do with what you teach and what you write about in the videos you have is we need to keep that education piece going, but it also can't be bastardized. You know, I'm going to sound like a broken record when I say this, but far too many times we get these fire celebrities who want to come out there and they want to get on the internet and create some social media page off of some buzzword, and all of a sudden they're a subject matter expert because they think that that's the buzzword. No, this is something that can't be bastardized. Just the same as suicide should have never been bastardized, but it was. You know, this is the same thing. This needs to be talked about in a serious fashion, but designed in a format that we have fun when we execute the training, so that the guys are kind of engaged more.
Well, you've hit some awesome points. It's that make some great segues. So, you know, the fire department's looking. Well, you know what? It's not my job. That's the cop's job. Okay, I got it. And as you said, let me get it straight. You'll go into a burning building, you know, completely surrounded by hazards, smoke, heat, et cetera, the way houses are now and the way that the products that we pack the house with, you're getting flashover way, way faster. And in a lot of cases, you might be getting flashover before you even get on scene. You're willing to go into that environment, but you're not so excited about going into this other environment. Well, we'll give you PPE and we're going to train you and all that. And it's possible that you could get shot at. It's not probable. It's not likely. It's absolutely going to happen. It's possible. So flip the coin. Let's go to the cops and say, hey, listen, we need you guys to start going into structure fires. Now don't get upset. We're going to give you air pack. We're going to give you bunker gear. And we're going to give you some training. And it'll be okay. Now, you possibly could get into a situation where you might have a flashover condition starting to show itself and you got to do some squirrely stuff. Possible. How many cops do you think are going to line up with their hand up in the air saying, yeah, sign me up for that? They're going to say the exact same thing. They're going to say, doesn't the fire department, like, down the street, isn't that what they do? Like, why? I don't want to do that. So it literally is what pair of glasses you happen to be wearing and what your vision is through those glasses as to whether or not this is something that you can comprehend or something that you're going to push back from. And a lot of it comes from experience. So there's that. The other side of that is, you know, well, do we really need to do this? Absolutely. You need to do it. It's the depth to which you need to do it that remains a question. And, you know, how do you go about figuring that out? How do you go about, as you said, one of the ways is, you know, make training fun. How do you go about getting people to want to go to the training, absorb the information, literally take it serious, pay attention, and retain it? some of that's making it fun, but as you said, how do we do that besides that? Well, I'll throw an oldie but a goodie at you. You got to do a needs assessment based off of a risk assessment and based off of, you know, your op tempo, your resources, your footprint, your relationship with law enforcement, your staffing, your ability to train with one another, equipment, et cetera. And once you've grasped or wrapped your hands around that, then you got to figure out where do we start and where are we really trying to go?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, the thing with the needs assessment, that in itself takes training. So you're 100% right. I'm not trying to say that. It's just...
Oh, you know I set you up. You know, I set you up for this all day.
No, I appreciate it. No, but, you know, so for the listener, you know, just don't just look like, oh, okay, Steve said I need to do a needs assessment. Like, know what you're supposed to be looking for, too. You know, a needs assessment is, I mean, it is literally that. It is a needs assessment, what you need. But, you know, you're seeing, and like Steve said about the op tempo, you know, what kind of calls you run, what the frequency of those calls are, you know, what the mission is for the area that you serve, you know, whether you guys are got a lot of high rises or you got a lot of you know, assisted living or senior areas or whatever. I mean, these are relevant things that you're going to need to conduct in your needs assessment and figure out, you know, the type of calls that you run for that and how prepared or not prepared or equipped you are for those type of things, what resources you would request, you know. But the other thing you hit was the relationship thing. I'm sure that was definitely the thing that you were spiking up for me to hit was, the, you know, just segueing me into the whole networking thing. I talk about it all the time. And I don't mean to sound, again, like I'm, you know, beating a dead horse, but I talk about it because to me, it's so friggin' simple. I don't understand, appreciate, you know, that Diane and Bobby and Ginger and they, you know, they bring me back to FDIC to talk about networking, right? I really appreciate that. But it also frustrates me that I have to teach about that at FDIC. Like how are these people not getting it? You know, like to me, like that's common sense. Like just talk to your neighbors. You know, like just talk to the cops. You're both going in the same call. Why are you not talking to them? And a case in point is where I work now, you know, at Letterkenny, not to be confused with the Hulu show, but those spelled the same. You know, we are in the very early stages, and it's not to knock the gentleman that was doing it before, but it just, the program, he had his own level of expertise. There's no doubt about it. And his own level of training and experience, having worn both hats in the fire and police side, as well as actually all three hats in the EMS side. But unfortunately, you know, that came with some kind of narcissism and kind of closed-mindedness. So the beauty with me is I don't know anything about this stuff, but I'm very interested in it. Because I know there's a need for it, and I know that at the end of the day, I'm responsible for making sure that my people can respond to this need. So myself and one of the police lieutenants have forged a relationship with each other, and through that now, you know, I have my firefighters doing meet and greets with the cops, and the cops are coming by the firehouse, and we're just talking. And we're talking about, you know, what their vision of our mission is, and especially when it comes to this type of thing, you know, like an active shooter response, and how well they feel we are or are not prepared to respond to these, and then, you know, then the dialogue opens with, you know, well, the police run three different shifts, the firemen don't, the firemen are there all day, so, you know, us working out then how we're going to schedule these meetings and then trainings with each shift. You know, odds are, yeah, you know, it's a stronger possibility and stronger percentage that this type of call could happen during the day. So my guys are going to know the daytime cops better. But also not going to allow my guys to not know the swing shift or the mid, you know, the guys that are in the middle of the night or whatever, you know, the overnight guys. They're going to know them. We're going to train with them. Maybe the frequency won't be as much as it will be with the daytime workers because logistically it's just, you know, it's easier to schedule that training during the day. But my people will train with them, the guys that are on the overnight, the guys that are on the mids, you know, the guys that they can potentially run into. And this is early stages, you know, we're already talking to we have a daycare, you know, and we're already talking to the daycare and setting up stuff with them. And we've already had quite a few meetings and I've had a few of my firemen and, you know, Lieutenant Boughton's had a few of his police officers. And we've gone to these meetings and we've all kind of aired our grievances, but also gave our suggestions. And we're actually running, you know, me and Lieutenant Boughton, we're calling it a crawl walk. Because we're going to run a drill next week, but it's not going to be a full run because we, you know, we know there's going to be a lot of gaps and a lot of failures, and that's where we're going to build our plan off of. Is that it's kind of like when you take those classes and they give you a test when you first get to the class, and you're certainly going to fail it, and then you know on Monday and then on Friday you go and take the test and you finally pass it because you learned all the information, you know, so you kind of exposed what you needed to learn. So that's what we're doing, you know, that kind of strategy. And I share that with you and with your audience because I'm not going to say that Letterkenny hasn't figured out because we're miles away from where we need to be with it. But I am going to say proudly with that I'm very proud of the effort on both sides of the coin, on both sides of the table within, you know, emergency services between us and the cops and the willingness to want to communicate and build a relationship with each other. Smoother of a transition than I thought it would be. So I say that, yeah. I don't mean to keep going, Steve, but I say that to the audience because believe it or not, man, it's not that hard. Like they are probably thinking the same thing you are of, you know, we should probably just start communicating with each other and start maybe trying to figure out how we can train together. But they're the same as you, you know, like Frank Ritchie always says, you know, remove the awkward divide. You know, it's like the girls on one side of the gym and the boys on the other, and nobody's dancing because each side is too afraid to ask each other to dance, you know. Screw that, man. Just talk to each other.
Well, and you hit several points of the initiation of your – or the initial steps of your needs assessment is do you have a relationship with the resources that you need to work with in order to accomplish the objective? And if the answer is no, well, there's where you need to start. And once you start to formulate that, whether you're doing, you know, cops and coffee or you're setting up meet and greets like you're doing, or you're just having a shift meal. I mean, the fire station kitchen table has solved the world's problems many times over. And speaking from the standpoint of being a cop, you feed a cop, you got a friend for life. This is kind of the same as if you feed a firefighter. You feed a firefighter a good meal, you got a friend for life. So that, you got to get that down. And I think that bullhorn has been screamed for at least the last 5 years or more of you need to form relationships, you need to do networking, you need to extend your hand, get a handshake and a smile, and go from there. A lot of people have done that or are doing that already. The next part of that is, well, what's our threat? What is our exposure to violent scene response? And the answer is very, very specific to your jurisdiction. It's very specific to your footprint. And we're banging the drum on active shooter, and I think it's awesome because with it is coming budgets and political support and things like that are necessary just to kind of get that ball rolling. But the big part of the threat and what kills firefighters annually for decades is domestic assaults, shootings, stabbings, fights, things like that. So you got to do a deep dive into your department's run data and try to identify violent scene calls that you go to and then tally them up. And how often are you going to these responses? And you get as specific as down to a shift and a company, or you can keep it broad. You can narrow it to neighborhoods or sections or jurisdictions within your footprint. You can get dynamic with it. I mean, most fire stations, you can walk in and say, "Hey, where's the shitty neighborhood in your response area?" And they'll tell you. They know. So they're aware. Integrating that with the cops, you can start to get some crime statistics. You can get some use of force statistics. You can see how often is law enforcement pointing and presenting their firearms. How often are they using more than command presence as use of force, and they're starting to use intermediary things like tasers and pepper spray and you know, hard closed fist hand control, things like that. You can start to articulate these things and start to look at a pattern of, you know, how close are we to having a significant injury or death in our organization from a scene that we go to that's not a fire and it's not a car wreck? You know, what is that looking like? And then you can start to extrapolate that out and figure out, okay, well, what do we need to train on? Well, how about interacting with law enforcement on a scene together? Everybody hates it, cops just as much. Well, incident command and NIMS, and okay, if you want to formalize it, awesome. If you don't want to formalize it, okay. If we're talking a couple of patrol cars and an engine company, how are you interacting with each other? Does law enforcement know that what the colored helmet system means in your department? And to look for the specific colored helmet to get answers and or direction or leadership out of the fire resources that are there. Stuff like that. Start to build that, and you can go from there. But if you can't wrap your arms around and articulate to naysayers, and that could be members of your own department, that could be members of brother and sister agencies, that could be political personnel within your senior leadership of your government. It could be a litany of people. It could be the general community. You have to be able to articulate the need to do the training in the first place, or the need to buy body armor, or the need to buy hemostat dressings and granules and all the different products that exist. You have to be able to articulate that. So how do you go about doing that? And it's going to start with that relationship that you discussed and your ability to say, well, in the last 6 months, we've responded to 17 shootings within the organization. That's a lot. Each one of those is an opportunity for something negative and bad to happen to a member of your organization. When you start to articulate things in numbers, people start to understand better than you saying, well, you know, it really sucks because there's been a lot of crap going on. That's not enough. That's not enough to talk about what you're trying to do. And then once you have that, how do you build that? How do you build the training? How do you integrate the training once you identify the need?
Wow. You know, there's a lot of good stuff that you covered. So just to answer the last question, you know, sure, that's rhetorical to the audience, but what I'll say is, again, not to play on words, it's just my strategy, it's my methodology, it's what works for me. And I can promise that I've tried other things and I've also allowed other people to interfere and tell me what works for them. And I'm always, because I network with people, so I'm always open ears, but at the end of the day, I execute on what works the most, and the crawl, walk, run thing works for me the most. And that's exactly how you do it. You know, you draft up the schedule of events, you know, whether you're doing a lecture and covering the statistics and the case studies and creating the awareness and you know types of calls and kind of table topping in on, well, you know, hey, if we went to this, what would we do here? You know, one of the things that got my brain thinking just now is you know, us as EMTs, it's a continuing education topic is responding to behavioral emergencies, you know, emotionally disturbed and behavioral emergencies. When have we ever trained on that other than just going through the, you know, the emergency book curriculum or, you know, going on NREMT's site and banging out, you know, clicking through it? When have we ever actually set up maybe a crawl, walk, run on that and actually done a drill where we're walking in because it's a call for a woman who fell down the steps and might have a broken ankle. And when we get there, it's pretty obvious that she was thrown down the steps. And the husband is a little off. I'm going to share a story real quick. Because I'm like ashamed of myself. Like I actually responded to one of these incidents. It was Super Bowl night, where I used to work, at a place that shall remain nameless just because they have a director there that, you know, he would love to try to, go against me if I incriminated him. So those who are listening that know me know exactly who I'm talking about, but the place that I worked at, has some high caliber people, some, mostly colonels and lieutenant colonels, you know, high brass people within the realm of the military. And, we get called out, for a, what was it? A gentleman who ended up hurting his head during the Super Bowl party. So I was a captain on the engine and you know, we went in, first response, you know, they call QRS over here, you know, quick response. And we provide the first initial part of the EMT care before it goes over to the ambulance for transport, et cetera. So we get on scene and the cop that's on scene, nobody tells us. I mean, we literally respond into the scene. All this had transpired, because the cop got on scene and it ended up being a domestic. The cop went to approach the gentleman, and the guy threw down on the cop. So, you know, kudos to the cop because he's good at his job. He ended up getting the guy in cuffs and throwing him in the back of his car. So we get on scene and I see the police officer and he's scratched up and a little bloody and I'm like, whoa, what's going on? And he's like, oh, this dude just jumped at me, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, oh. I'm like, you know, so I tell my guys, I'm like, yeah, back up real quick. So I'm like, where's the guy? So he's like, well, I got him in cuffs. He's in the back of my car. So we open up the door, and, you know, a buddy of mine, Andy, you know, he says, sir, with the fire department. The guy goes, F you. So we close the cruiser door, you know. He goes, well, he's alert. And he's oriented. Well, maybe he's not oriented, but he has an airway. I said, yeah, technically, I guess you're right. You know, yeah. So anyway, so we go and, you know, we check out the rest of the scene, and this ended up being like some Jerry Springer stuff. You know, it seemed like maybe there was like maybe some swinger stuff going on, and somebody got a little jealous, and it ended up going down pretty bad. So he had apparently he had put his hands on her, and then the other guy got involved. And they got into it, and then he ended up putting his hands on the cop, and so on and so forth. And so the point is, you know, this is an emotionally disturbed person. This is a behavioral emergency. We every 3 years, that's one of the required continuing education credits that we have to do as EMTs. But we just click through it, and this happened, Christ, I don't even know, I think 2015 or something like that. And it just dawned on me now while you're explaining this story, you know, that is exactly it. So for the listener, you know, hey, listen, like, though it's very important to sit here and advocate and cheerlead for responding to active shooter and standing up rescue task forces and all that, on the norm, you know, the whole premise of Steve's show, responding to scenes of violence, we don't even realize that we normally go to these things. I mean, this was, I was in a controlled military installation that is, you know, not like your average military base. It was some high brass people there that you wouldn't think that this would happen. And something like that happened. That was 2015, so it's 2022. So, you know, at least twice, two, three times, I've taken the behavioral emergency response training for my con eds for my EMT, and it never dawned on me that that's something that we should probably train on better on how we would approach that scene. You know, we responded into that scene as the firemen without knowing, because it all went down while we were en route, that it was a hostile scene and that it was an unsafe scene. So we were, by the time we were on scene, we were already in the shit. So, you know, you don't always get that luxury of PD getting on scene first and saying, hey, you know, FD stage over there, I'll let you know when it's safe. And, you know, case in point, this happened. And then when I was up at West Point, you know, we had a frequent flyer. We had a kid who was, unfortunately, he was autistic, but, you know, he was an emotionally disturbed kid. And then regularly we would go there. I mean, times where he beat up his mother. He had a knife. He had a knife, you know, on him trying to come at us, trying to come at the cops. So I've been to these scenes just while you were talking about it. Me, myself, I've been on these scenes multiple times just over the past 5-6 years. and I'm like, here, I'm responsible for managing a training program, and I never even thought that there's some relevant training there. And we're not really prepared to respond to that. So my challenge to the listener is kind of have the epiphany I just had of, you know, find a way to make that a little more appealing to your crew so that they don't just go through the motions and it's redundant. But that's a real call that we all respond to. And how prepared are we, and what are we going to do? What steps are we going to take to be prepared?
Well, and therein lies the rub. So you can identify that kind of stuff and be like, okay, well, how are we going to deal with this? It requires a huge amount of support and backing from leadership in multiple agencies in order to get this done. And the way I try to articulate it is, we don't teach firefighters how to fight a 4-alarm fire until we've taught them how to fight a room and content fire. So what we're essentially doing, if you look at the last couple of years across the country, we're attempting to come up with a global solution to riots, to active shooter, to vehicle as a weapon. Fire as a weapon is starting to turn its head and get a little bit more creative and grab a couple of headlines here and there. But we're those types of things where we have dozens to possibly hundreds of potential victims, patients, when we're talking about that big scale event. Now we have people's attention. Now it's like, yeah, clear your schedule. Here's six figures to support your training initiative and resource acquisition. That's great. But we're trying to train people to fight a 4-alarm fire, and we haven't gotten a room and content down yet. So I go back to what I said before, when you grab analytics from your op tempo and your run data and linking that with law enforcement's data, now you have some teeth to articulate the need to carve time out for training, to shave a little off the budget and put it in this pot over here to dive into this topic. And it's hard. It's really hard. Probably 99.9% of all the listeners that tune into Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio are firefighters. So speaking to that, if we were to come up with a 40-hour annual mandated training that you have little knowledge and experience in. How are you going to integrate that into your training in a year with your work schedule? And the answer for us is simple in concept, but in actually executing, it's a little different. We'll cut a little of this out, and we'll cut a little of that topic out, or we'll shave some of this off the annual training plan and table that for a later time or something like that. But from law enforcement standpoint, as you said earlier, law enforcement might be operating three shifts. They might be operating four shifts. It can be pretty dynamic, but they're working the road. And when they're working the road, they're already operating under limited resources. So unless you're a major metropolitan area where you can tweak some stuff, but you're operating then with a limited crew and limited personnel. So you have to maintain coverage on the road for emergent call response. So you're not going to be able to just say, well, we'll take all the on-duty people in the region for this law enforcement agency, and, you know, the last couple hours of their shift, we'll just, you know, we'll execute some training. That's not that simple, and you're not going to be able to do that, not effectively anyway. The other aspect is what that is carved out for training for law enforcement is very, very specific. And you could set an egg, you could set your watch to it. You could time it with an egg timer. It's here's your shifts. Here is your mandatory training that the state requires to maintain your law enforcement credentials and any other additional certifications or specialties that you have. And, oh, by the way, so now you have to do court as well. There's not a lot of time in a law enforcement officer's schedule to just say, hey, we're going to train with the fire department today. That requires senior leadership buy-in. That requires the local government to agree to pay monies for overtime or shift coverage and identify a training day and et cetera in order to accomplish that. It's not as simple as just grabbing the shift supervisors of an area and say, hey, we're going to do some training. You're not going to be able to do that. Some of the law enforcement coverage areas for a single patrol car is 30, 40 miles. You know, you can't pool all those law enforcement officers in a single location where they're going to have a 20, 40 minute response time to get to a hot call. They're spread out geographically and it's meant for a reason. So it's not cut and dry. And I think that's why, part of the reason why we are not training with law enforcement on the day-to-day things. And as we know in firefighting, if you can't get the day-to-day stuff down, if you can't come to work, put your gear on the truck, check out your air pack, if you don't have that kind of attitude, if you're not doing that, when the big one hits and the bells go off, it's going to be a disaster. And it's just not going to go well. This is exactly the same thing.
Yeah, sure it is. Like you said, I'm trying to choose my words wisely.
I'm nervous now.
I
got to choose my words wisely.
Oh yeah, because it's an issue that I'm currently dealing with. So I don't want to get myself in some kind of trouble here. So I'll dance around it and say, I agree. And the listener, if you have people that are listening to this, whether now, live, or later, and they're in a position of being a decision maker, and what I mean by that is like a budget approval, expense approvals, overtime costs, emphasis on that last one, understand the need. this isn't one of them stupid things where we're trying to just squirrel overtime to get guys extra time and a half. The need is real. The struggle is real. The demand is real. And on both sides of the spectrum, the police side and the you know, and I'm coupling together fire and EMS because they kind of go hand in hand, especially in this type of thing. You know, we don't have the luxury to just meet up whenever. Like I said early on about, you know, the police department where I work, they work 3/8. You know, they have a 6 to 2, a 2 to 10, and a 10 to 6 or whatever the hell it is. Yeah. So, you know, the firemen work a 48. They work 2 days on. You know, that's their shift. They do 2 days straight and they're off for a few days. So it's you're not going to get all the same people at the same time when you need to get them. So you need to understand that your personal feelings on budgets or, you know, your higher power who might be in charge of you is breathing down your neck about, hey, overtime, overtime, overtime. You know, I got it. Case in point, you know, let's just talk about COVID real quick. I can't wait until we live in a normal society where we don't talk about it like it's prevalent thing and it just becomes kind of the flu. I realize it exists and it can be deadly and it's taxing on somebody's health. But, you know, I pray for the day that we get back to normal. So what I will say, and then I'm going to dismiss it off the table because I'm so tired of friggin' talking about it. But COVID is new. Well, it was, especially when it first came out. And we didn't know how to react and respond to it, right? So in the fire side and the police side, you know, we're exposed. So then they're telling us, oh, well, you know, because you were exposed, you can't come to work, so you got to be off. And, you know, and then the people that, you know, are the shitbags that will try to milk the system and take advantage of that, they'll lie and say, yeah, I was around the guy who coughed once, so I get 10 free days off now too, right? Ha-ha, you know. So, you know, you got to realize just because of that in itself increased your overtime rates in both the police and fire side, because we have to maintain a certain amount of staffing to be ready to respond at, you know, minimum amount of staffing to be able to respond to some kind of crazy catastrophic thing in the event that it happens. So we're hiring back overtime because we're dealing with this global pandemic that we really don't know how to deal with right now because it got so damn politicized. So now, you know, we're like, well, hey, you know, we really got to train on these other things that are important, as well as we need to really train on how we respond to scenes of violence and how we respond to, you know, an active shooter and how we stand up in a rescue task force. And just because of scheduling alone, okay, you have to hire back the overtime. You have to. You know, if you're in a volunteer organization, maybe you don't have to, but it's even difficult then because you have a full-time job, odds are. So you have to now find a way to be free from your job and your family so that you can train with the cops. They have to hire back overtime so that they can train. So regardless, it's logistically, it's going to take a financial effect. But this is where I get frustrated, and I said I'm trying to choose my words wisely with the bean counters or the decision makers. Is, you know, we're in a business of dealing with lives and property, and I strike that word business. You know, we provide a service, and I know that we've mucked it up ourselves by taking advantage of the system and squirreling overtime when we really didn't need to. And you get some scumbags out there that have beaten the system up. But when it comes to shit like this, like when it comes to training, especially training together, you know, it's all you hear from the outsider is, you know, why are cops and firemen not doing more together? And, you know, hey, I heard this shiny widget about RTS, so we need to do that too, right? You know, and it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, we're going to have to hire overtime. Well, you guys got to find a way to make it work without having to do overtime, you know. We can't have an impact on overtime. Well, I mean, what do you want us to do here? We're providing a service. it's impossible for the schedules to line up. So it's inevitable that we have to hire the overtime. And this is where I get frustrated. You see the, you hear the passion in my voice about it, because it's like, to me, it's like, again, I get frustrated with common sense. Like, obviously we need to train on this, and obviously we work two different schedules. So obviously you have to, you're going to have to pay to compensate people to come in on the times that they're not typically ready to be there. So just do it. Of all the crap that we find things to waste money on, this is to prepare us to provide a service for a major catastrophic event. I just kind of feel like it's just hands down justified. It shouldn't even have to be explained. So for the listener, you know, find a way to schedule it out that you can prove that you're doing your due diligence of trying to soften the blow of the financial costs of the of budget and payroll. But if you're a decision maker in your organization, you're listening to the show, please, now, I'm not trying to be a jerk with it, but please, you know, use your brain, bro. Like, obviously you need to hire back overtime, so you should be open-minded to that. This is the one time where it's certainly justified. You know, of all the other crap that you try to have them go to, you know, this is probably the one thing that's justified.
I think it's valid. And I think a lot of organizations struggle with articulating the risk and articulating the need. So if you're not, if your agency is not deeply involved in providing the data and the talking points to your senior leadership, control purse strings and staffing and et cetera, then you got to figure a way to wiggle yourself into that. If you're allowing somebody with a master's degree and a calculator and coming up with, you know, 2.6 firefighters per seat, per truck, per shift, whatever, you're doing yourself and you're doing your agency a disservice, which eventually is doing the community a disservice. Now, can we argue that in Las Vegas, Clark County, where the Route 91 shooting, can we argue that they did not have enough dispatchers on duty to handle that event? Absolutely. No doubt. Excuse me. The actual amount of dispatchers that were off duty and self-dispatched into work to help handle the 911 center was nearly double the amount of personnel who were on duty at the time the event kicked off. So quantify that for a minute. Are we saying that we need three times the amount of dispatchers or double the amount of dispatchers that we currently have? You're not going to be able to sell that. That's not, you can't articulate that and say, well, we need to triple the staffing of this, of each shift in the 911 center. We got to hire like 50 people. That's going to be a no. So if you're looking at incidents like that and trying to model your argument or model your position for why you need X, you're probably not going to convince the person with the bow tie and the calculator that's a demonstrable risk that you need to prepare for. Now, having said that, you can articulate that the exposure, the daily exposure, is something that you need to concern yourselves with. If the struggle is to get body armor because you want personnel to be in body armor in the event that they go to an active shooter, I'm willing to bet that I can dive into your run data for the last 2 years and articulate a need for you to have body armor or some modality of it. Not every position, every truck, every individual, but actually have it on the street and the ability to put it on a scene for a first alarm type of an assignment. I can argue that based on your run data for the last couple of years. And having nothing to do with active shooter. Active shooter's a cherry. That's frosting. That's, oh, and hey, by the way, this is something that we would need for active shooter anyway. That could be the nudge. So the goal is to keep your personnel safe. Opening your eyes to how to articulate that is another matter. Focus on the day-to-day stuff. Focus on the everyday stuff that you go to. And if you argue it that way and you discuss risk being risk to safety, risk to personnel being out on workers' comp injury for the rest of their career, the traumatic mental and emotional aspects to the crew that had to endure an attack or watching one of their fellow crew members traumatically injured or fatally injured, you could wipe out an entire company on a single event. And by the way, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for those individuals who now need traumatic therapy, who may not be able to step on the truck again, ever. There's that. There's the liability for that, fiduciary liability, your civil exposure to lawsuits and such. How about politically, your exposure when the media gets a hold of this incident, event, whatever it may be, and they say, gee, Mr. and Mrs. Mayor, how come you weren't meeting national standards at a bare minimum? Why wasn't that being done? Do you want to accept all those risk factors? And from there, push to try to get your support for training dollars, for overtime, for, you know, flexing shift times, for doing the different things that you need to do to put butts in the seats and get the training done. And we have so many barriers and obstacles to deal with even before COVID, but COVID has made it almost unachievable. Not being able to do face-to-face training, having to telework and all the different things that we're looking at to try to avoid exposure to COVID is reducing our ability to stay proficient and actually expand knowledge, skills, and abilities into areas that we don't necessarily touch all that much. So it's a huge challenge and it's crazy. But I think the biggest pill to swallow, the biggest aspect of this is trying to integrate that training at the basic boots on the ground level between fire, law enforcement, and EMS, and trying to get that done under whatever confines the leadership puts upon you.
I could not agree more. That in lies the problem there. But I will say, you're absolutely right. You know, you got to do your homework as far as the proper information to articulate and justify your need, because unfortunately, that's the way some of these people receive it. You know, they don't receive it. It's not common sense to them. You know, it's another language to them. And maybe that's why I get so frustrated, because, you know, I'm just like, well, I'm trying to explain it to you in the best way I can, and you still don't understand it. So my advice to people is just what you said, Steve, is try to find the best way possible to articulate the information, the facts that you need to speak their language in a term or in the terms that it justifies your need.
Yeah, it's literally the same process that we built when we came up with the new training format for Army Fire and Emergency Services. Where are our current capabilities? Where do we assess we need to be? What's the risk if we don't get there? Or what's the risk if we table it or push it or whatever the circumstances are? And what is our op tempo and what things do we need to cover first? So if you're running 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 fire alarm activations a year, how much time do we need to dedicate to understanding fire alarm systems and, you know, tracking down and fixing issues with fire alarm panels and interpreting annunciator panels and things like that? We do that every day. It's like putting on your pants. So what other things do we have to concern ourselves with? And in the violent scene response world, start collecting data. Data is the number one driving force for everything. And if we're not painting the picture in the numbers that people can understand, then we've lost the argument before we even try to have a discussion. So start identifying what scenes did you go to that you did not feel comfortable, where you felt that there was a risk to your safety that you had no control over, or that you had poor communication with law enforcement, or the fact that you didn't have their radio channels, you didn't get updated and understand what you were going to, or that there was a problem with dispatch and, you know, correlating the information from the call taker to the dispatcher to you to the cops, et cetera. Start grabbing that information and writing it down. And if you go to a scene and you have somebody like you had with tussling with the cop, I'm glad you didn't get, you know, 60 seconds faster. I'm glad you didn't get there before the cop did. I'm glad the cop responded, period. So, you know, all those factors could have came into that. But, you know, have you ever been hit by a patient? You ever been punched by a patient, pushed by a patient, threatened by a patient, a bystander? Of course. Some way more regularly than others. How are you capturing that? Because all of that stuff leads to other things that are much more damning than simply getting punched in the face. You get punched in the face. Did you break a bone? Did you break your nose? Do you got a cut? Do you need stitches? Okay, here, rub some sand on it, and, you know, we'll talk about that at the kitchen table for the next 4 or 5 years about the time you got punched in the face by a patient. But what was that risk? You know what I mean? What was that risk? How could that have gone different? And how often does that happen? It happens a hell of a lot more frequently than people realize. But the data that we're able to grab nationally, the data that you're able to grab in your organization, is workers' comp. Did you get hurt or did you get injured? If you got hurt, well, you can still play. You'll be all right. If you got injured, your name's going on a list and you're ineligible. You know, that's time off. That's medical expenses. Okay, we capture that. But how more frequent is it that you get hurt on a scene because things went south and you didn't get injured? You know what I mean? So grab that. Once you have all these data points, that's when you have to take that relationship that you started building, and you have to say, hey, I've been crunching numbers, and I think we're on the precipice of a very, very big problem, and we're going to have to try to work this out. And what can we do? What can we do right now? What can we do today? What can we do in a month? What can we do in 3 months? And start trying to figure out ways to get butts in seats and get knowledge, or get people to do quick drills off the cuff, real fast. Walk a building in your jurisdiction with the cops and just have a chat about the building, about the layout, about, you know, the challenges that law enforcement would have if they had to come to this building for a hot call. And you can share some of the knowledge that you have about the challenges if we were going there for a fire. That's training. You're training each other. You can do that. That takes 15 minutes. That doesn't necessarily need to be on a schedule, and that doesn't cost a dime. Do that. So the next time you want to go out and pre-plan something, that relationship that you forged with law enforcement, where you have that first name basis with a patrol supervisor or the patrol officer in your jurisdiction, why don't you shoot him a text or something and say, hey, what are you doing right now? Hey, why don't you meet us over here at this building? Hey, we're going to walk through here real quick. You know, we had to base it off of a call. Hey, remember we came over here for a fight in the employee break room, and wow, man, that was crazy. Can you imagine if this door was locked this way, or if this was blocking this, or if there was 100 people in here, and how would we work that out, and the parking situation for the apparatus and the patrol cars and blah, 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 blah. And you're solving problems by having a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I got my wheels turning already because there's going to be a big focus on pre-fire plan and building walkthroughs, so I might start inviting them out to certain buildings. That's a good idea.
If you want to start an active shooter plan, training aside, and my class at FDIC this year is a little different years past. I'm going to be doing a workshop on pre-planning for an active shooter. So we're going to talk about some of this stuff, and we're actually going to walk through a little bit of it. But get fire, EMS, and law enforcement to walk through your building a high hazard occupancy, for high hazard for an active shooter. So movie theater, mall, any public assembly facility. Now, one of the big things that concerns me, as you brought it up with COVID, as mandates are coming out, as we're saying people need to do X, Y, and Z, and you need to wear a mask, or you have to get vaccinated, or whatever the circumstances are, and there are those who choose not to do that. And now we start laying those people off. Now we start firing those people. So the economy is not in the greatest shape that it could be. Society-wide, there seems to be this whole pent-up angst that is just waiting to pop. And now we're going to start laying people off. We are creating a mental health crisis like we've never seen before. The ripple effects of this are going to be mythic. So you're the recipe for you to have a workplace active shooter, in my opinion, is way higher now than it has ever been. And I think the only thing that saved us for the last 18 months was teleworking and people staying at home and being subsidized for not being able to work because their business was closed or whatever. I really think that really has saved us. But I don't think it's going to save us forever. So walk through those buildings and whatever they are in your footprint, you know what it is. Walk through those buildings with those individuals with a clipboard and just start writing stuff down. You know, gee whiz, these doors look pretty difficult to force. Law enforcement, you guys know how to force these doors. If we can't come up and support you in forcible entry, what kind of tools do you have? Real quick and in a hurry, you're going to find law enforcement's got a three-piece hooligan tool that's a piece of garbage that you're going to break under stress and not using proper technique as opposed to a single-piece Halligan. There's a problem you just identified right there. What's the solution to that? Can you fix that? Stuff like that. Once you go through that, you will be able to identify resource stuff that you need, training stuff that you need, and you are training people just in that right there and say, go back to your organization, go back to your shift and speak about what we talked about here today and pass the word along. Is it very formal? No. It's better than nothing. And it's what leads to formal when you put that stuff on paper, slap it in a three-ring binder or put it on a computer, and you have the basis for a plan and you can go from there. That can be training. So there are options for you to incorporate some type of training that you can do immediately and some that you need to push out. You need to be able to push out TECC. You need to be able to push out Stop the Bleed education to public assembly, business employees and workers. You need to be able to push out building clearing, incident command, things like that. but it doesn't mean you can't train. So if your big push is to get everybody in a room and we're going to do RTF training for the next 3 months, and you get pissed because you can't get the first class off the ground because of scheduling and budget and COVID and everything else, find another way to at least start to increase knowledge, skill, and ability that was not there yesterday. And I think we are right at a little over an hour. Dave, you and I could talk about this all night. However, I don't think people want to listen to us talk about this all night.
No. That's all right, though.
I'm betting. And you know what? Hold on 1 second, because we have a caller.
Oh, wow.
So hang on 1 moment.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Scenes of Violence. Who are we talking to?
Hey, my name's Khalil, and I called maybe last night or the night before last. But one of the things that they should make sure of is that all the exit signs are working properly and stuff like that, and maybe, get some, a few officers, if the patrol officers don't have, long rifles, and the patrol officers don't have training in paramedics, they should get, tactical paramedics and maybe some detectives that have long rifles and that have medical care things. Because I know, some of the officers are more equipped than others.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that's a great point.
It's unfortunate.
That goes part two.
Each department's very different. That's the thing, you know. So you get some tactical medics, and then you get some like you said before, you know, just some police officers that have zero training or certification or experience in that. So yeah, I mean, that is a good point to try to get some cross training so that people are kind of multi-hatting it. Yeah.
That goes towards what we were talking about before with, you know, the resources and articulating needs based on your assessment of your organization. What kind of resources do we need? You know, if we identify that law enforcement doesn't have long guns, you know, if you bring a long gun, if you're not bringing a long gun to a fight with somebody else with a long gun, you're going to lose.
Right.
That's just what it's going to be. So, you know, you don't bring a pistol to a shotgun fight. You bring a rifle to a shotgun fight. That's how you're going to beat the shotgun. So you, if you are lacking in that, hopefully through that assessment process, you will identify those things. Now, those types of firearms, they're expensive. They're ridiculously expensive. And the ammo to them are expensive. And to certify an officer in that firearm platform, you're talking 500 rounds per officer just to get certified in it. And then you have annual. So that's a big, big cost. And it's a real cost. So articulating some of that as part of that process is a big thing. So yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up and making that point.
Welcome. Cause see, to me, if you don't have patrol officers with that stuff, detectives and special agents should be at hand. Even if it's not a federal crime, they should have special agents maybe to help with that, to bring them down and have the police, once they're down, local police arrest the people. Or state police.
Yeah. Hey, so real quick, because we didn't get to touch on that. I don't mean to take away from the points that you're making. Just what's your name and where are you calling from?
Khalil. I'm calling from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh, okay. Nice. Well, yeah, thanks for calling in, man. That's awesome. Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yep.
A lot of history.
That's
in
part
that
of
area,
that.
Man. That's revolutionary, where it was Civil War, all went through there. It's nuts.
Well, as you were saying, that's part of that assessment process is to identify those things. And, you know, as you said, you know, state police, federal law enforcement, you know, jurisdictional boundaries kind of melt away when we're talking about, you know, active shooter response and things like that. So, yeah, they're coming. It's what to do with them all when they get there is another matter, but that's for a completely different show. So, again, we hit that magic hour mark. We exceeded it a little bit. So we're going to wrap this in real quick. I thank everybody for their time and choosing to listen to Dave and I ramble about all kinds of fun things. And Dave, I'm going to traditionally leave you with the last word and any final thoughts you want to throw out there about all this stuff we were talking about tonight.
I appreciate it. No, just food for thought for everybody listening to the show. We went a little past the hour, so if you're listening toward the end here, one, thank you. But, you know, two, thank you to you, Steve. I appreciate you having me on, brother. You know that. But for everybody, we need to bear down. We need to be patient, but we need to stay the course and be persistent at the same token. You know, it's there's a lot of stuff that we should be doing and ways that we can be doing it. We just got to find out how to do it. Just because it's can be perceived as stigmatic or a challenge doesn't mean that we just say, oh, well, you know, I guess we're not going to do that. Like, no, you know, we're going to respond to it inevitably anyway. And like Steve said, you know, especially everything going on in the country, it's just sooner than later it's going to happen. And it's sad to say, but the better prepared we are, you know, the better job and the safer we're going to be in the outcome of it. So, yeah, that's all. But thank you, man. I really, you know, I love you and I appreciate you. Oh, and then happy birthday to Steve. His birthday was 2 days ago. So happy birthday, brother. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And
yeah,
I'll get you back for that.
Yep.
So, again, thank you, for everybody tuning in. And, you know, I think the points we're hitting is do something. If your goal is to get a cert, that's awesome. If your goal is to become qualified, that's awesome. If you can't get there, knowledge is better than doing nothing. So even if it's a nugget, that stuff builds. So fill your bag with nuggets and in any way that you can. And if that means 15 minutes, 15 minutes is better than not talking about it at all. So thank you very much, Dave. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you. Appreciate you coming on. And we will see you all in about 6 weeks. We will do another episode of Scenes of Violence, and we will discuss whatever seems to be hot and important at that time. I hope there's nothing glaring that's going to be added to that. So God bless. Everybody stay safe, and we will all see you again soon.